happens when you break local Suzy. Suzy breaking in supergravity well, there's just a few facts that are useful to know. The supergravity multiplet, in other words, graviton and the gravitino, they contain new auxiliary fields. So let's call them FG. And these can acquire vacuum expectation values when we have Suzy breaking. So, VEV of FG is not naught. Yeah. There's no kinetic term. That defines an auxiliary field. So then you can just eliminate it. It's not going to appear in any... It can't propagate, so you have no lines and loops and stuff there. So you can just eliminate it by using the field equations of motion. Field equations. So remember, we have this covariant derivative appearing in the scalar potential, supergravity covariant derivative, big DI times the acting on the superpotential, which was partial derivative with respect to superfield I of the superpotential plus partial derivative of the Kähler potential times the superpotential over m Planck squared. And the F terms of the superfields phi I are proportional to DIW. So remember, in global Suzy, we don't have this second term, and the F term is just proportional to dW by d phi I. And we remember our extended F term potential which have this extra term, minus 3w squared over m Planck squared. So this term is new in supergravity, new feature. And whereas in global Suzy we had to have the potential being positive, but now we have this negative term, so we may have V bigger than, less than, or equal to zero, even after Suzy breaking. With supergravity. So when you make supersymmetry local, that changes. And that's welcome, because the cosmological constant from observations on scales of m Planck is basically zero. So we want to be able to fix it to 10 to the minus 3 eV to the fourth, which seems to be the value of the energy density of the vacuum, which would make the universe accelerate as it's accelerating right now. So, good. So we want to make potential equal to zero, actually, essentially, otherwise the universe would be accelerating far too much. So if we just left it at the global limit, you tend to get a value of the cosmological constant that was 10 to the 60 times larger than is observed. That's a big factor. Yeah, so in global SUSY, global broken SUSY implies that vacuum energy density is of order 100 GeV to the 4, whereas it's observed, it's inferred to be 10 to the minus 3 electron volts to the 4th from cosmological observation. So in the super Higgs mechanism, the supersymmetric analogy to the Higgs mechanism, the Goldsteino is eaten by the gravitino, which then acquires a mass. So the Goldsteino forms the spin 1/2 component, of the massive spin 3/2 field. Okay, so I don't know if any of you have looked at the news. But this morning at 12:58 Central European Time, there were successful collisions at 7 TeV at the LHC. Sorry?
And no black holes?
No black holes yet. Well, not in the last picosecond or so. Well, up to the last picosecond. No. That's right. So, hopefully all this stuff we've been talking about over the last 3 weeks will be being produced in a collider, or at least some version of what we've been talking about. And that's what I'm going to go on to talk to you about next, is the minimal supersymmetric version of the Standard Model. So this is the version relevant for cosmology, or one of the versions. Either this or some extension to it are what we're thinking of will be the states of which will be produced at the Large Hadron Collider in these high-energy collisions. So let's introduce the minimal supersymmetric Standard Model. So someone kind of unfortunately added this M here. Because now you get this like crazy nomenclature where people talk about the NMSSM, which is the next to minimal supersymmetric Standard Model, the MNMSSM, which is the minimal next to minimal supersymmetric Standard Model, and it's going a bit crazy. But basically the idea here is you've got N equals 1 SUSY. You only really worry for now about global SUSY, but we'll talk about local SUSY when we talk about SUSY breaking, times the Standard Model, so direct product with the Standard Model gate group. And I want to draw the spectrum So what we use are N equals 1 chiral superfields. So if you remember, they contain a left-handed fermion and a scalar. But as you know, in the standard model, we have right-handed fermions. So you've got a choice. You can either put the right-handed guys in anti-chiral superfields, or you can just put the anti-right-handed guys into chiral superfields. Because, for example, if you take an upright quark and take the bar of the whole thing, so you've got to be careful in which order you're doing the right-handed projection and the bar. This is left-handed, this whole thing. So an anti-right-handed quark is left-handed. So P left acting on that is... So what you can do is just put the U right bar into a chiral superfield, okay? So let's say what we've got. So we're going to have a bunch of vector superfields because we've got gauge bosons which need to go into vector superfields. So I'm going to put the representation under standard model gauge groups. So we have the vectors superfields and we have some chiral superfields. And for the vector superfields we have the gluons and gluinos. So fermion and boson. So the gluino is written like that, with a tilde, and the spin 1 boson is written with either small or capital G. And then we have some W bosons of SU2, so they're adjoints under the SU2 rep, singlets of everything else. And we have weinos as the spin 1/2 components, and the W123 is the bosons. And then we have the hypercharge boson B, 110, the partner of which is called a beano. And we have the hypercharge boson as spin 1 object. Okay, so that's good. In the chiral superfields, we put all our matter. So you remember from the standard model that we have three families now, families I'm going to label with I, J, and K that go from 1 to 3. That's a family index. Family. So we have our left-handed quark doublet, which is 3, 2, and a sixth. So, U, D, left, I. These are the quarks, and they have spin 0 partners, squarks. So all the super partners are written with a tilde, and scalars of course aren't really left-handed or right-handed, but these are the copies of the left-handed guys. So to distinguish them from the other ones, you put a little label L on them.
What's the subscript on Q?
It's the family index, 1, 2, 3. It's L and the family index. It looks like a 4, yeah. So it's L, I, Yeah. Yeah, so I should really have an eye here. Okay, and then we have a similar thing for the lepton doublet. Minus a half hypercharge. So here we have a sneutrino and a selectron. Okay, and then we've got all the right-handed guys. So, for example, our up, our U bars. Okay, U right-handed bar. And this one, because it's an anti-quark, it's in a three-bar representation of SU3. It's got no SU2 quantum numbers, and hypercharge of -2/3. So it has a squawk partner, which we denote with the right. And because it's an anti-particle, the chiral superfield contains the anti-squawk. And it's the same for all the others, so speed up a bit. IR bar, 3 bar, 1/3. So, all of these guys are spin zero, of course. So what we see here is for every quark we know about, so the up quark, we actually have two scalar copies. We have a left-handed U left and U right. So there's one for each spin component of the up quark, basically. Supersymmetry tells you that correspondence ought to be there. So this is Higgs doublet, H1. Sorry. I'm going to write it in terms of... So for reasons that will become clear in a second, we have the Higgs doublet. It's called H2 in this model. So this, for this guy, the standard model particle is just the Higgs doublet. And the copy now is the spin half partner, the Higgs Xenos. Right, there's a problem with this spectrum. And as you saw in a tutorial after the second lecture, there's a problem in general with chiral fermions because, in general, you can get anomalies. But in the standard model, so, okay, we don't have to worry about these guys. These are not chiral. They're Majorana fermions. And so they don't contribute anything. They're in a real representation anyway. This adjoint representation is real of the gauge group. So they don't contribute to the anomaly. But all these guys are chiral, and they do. But in the standard model, we showed that the chiral anomaly cancels. So, for example, the hypercharged cubed anomaly cancels for each family of standard model particle. But we've just added another chiral fermion, and that chiral fermion has non-zero hypercharge, and so that's going to just everything else cancels, and you get an anomaly from this guy. That's not going to cut it. That means that we can't write hypercharge as a gauge symmetry. So the easiest thing to do, and in fact what's done in the MSSM, is to add another Higgs doublet with opposite hypercharge. Remember, the anomaly, hypercharge anomaly comes in as y cubed. So this is going to just completely cancel the anomaly from the H1. So this thing has electric charges 0 and minus. And it comes in with its supersymmetric partner as well. So that's one reason why the MSSM is a two Higgs doublet model. There is another reason too, which we'll see in a minute. Okay, so now let's write down the superpotential among all our chiral superfields. So I think what I'm going to do is give you the gauge, all the gauge indices and all their horrendous glory. So X, Y, and Z go from their color indices going from 1 to 3. I'll write A and B as SU2 fundamental indices going from 1 to 2. And I'll write I, J, and K as family indices, just going from 1 to 3. Do I need any others? No. Good. So the usual MSSM superpotential, W, and I'll explain this in a minute. Looks like this. So what we do is we write down all fields which are gauge invariant under SU3, SU2, and U1, all products of superfields. So if we look at this term in terms of color, the quark is a 3 of color, and the anti-quark is a 3 bar, and a 3 cross the 3 bar contains a singlet of color. 3 cross 3 bar of color is 8 plus 1. So we project out the singlet from structure from this term. If we look at SU2, both of these two things are doublets, and we can project out a singlet from the product of two doublets. And the way that we do that is just by anti-symmetrizing. So A equals 1 corresponds to the left-handed up quark, A equals 2 corresponds to the left-handed down quark, for instance. So all we do is we multiply by epsilon AB, and that projects out the singlet component of SU2. So I should write the SU3 indices here. So this quark has an SU3 index, and the anti-quark has an anti-SU3 index. She's downstairs, and they're just summed over. So you can tell by the fact that there's no indices left over that they're all soaked up by summations and invariant tensors under the group, that this is going to be invariant under a SU3 cross SU2 transformation. And then the only other thing you have to worry about is U1. And you just check that the hypercharges of these fields add up to zero. And they do. You can check. And then it's invariant under the standard model gauge group. And it's holomorphic in terms of these chiral superfields. Okay, it looks a bit odd because I've written a U bar, but it's just, this is still a chiral superfield. It's not the dagger of a chiral superfield. So this is holomorphic. And then we have the equivalent. Ah, I should point out, this thing is a matrix, 3x3 matrix in family space of dimensionless coupling constants. So this is a trilinear term in the superfields, and we have an equivalent term involving down quarks and there is a term involving the leptons. So the leptons now, of course, don't have a color index. And the only other term which is usually considered to be part of the MSSM is this mass term, bilinear term for the Higgs doublets, H1, H2, and mu has dimensions of mass. So it's measured in GeV. And it's going to do things like, it gives a mass term for each of the Higgs doublets, and it gives a mass to the Higgsinos as well. So the YU, YD, and YE matrices are Yukawa couplings. And you'll notice that there's no mass terms in here for quarks and leptons. So to begin with, there's no bilinear terms involved in the quarks. That means their Majorana masses are zero. And it's the standard model symmetry and the holomorphy of the superpotential that tells you that. Yeah?
Why is the second term of the coefficient?
I'm sorry?
Why is the second term of the U? Why is U's coefficient negative?
Why is which? Which all these coefficients positive? Yeah. But I mean, if I did put a minus there, it would just be a definition of, I mean, you can rephase that minus away. It doesn't have any physical effects, because you can just redefine, say, Q primed is minus Q, and you wouldn't be able to tell. So let's have a look at one of these terms, because actually what happens is the Higgs mechanism kicks in. These two Higgses get vacuum expectation values, and that, just like in the standard model, except it's a two Higgs doublet model, that gives masses to the quarks and the leptons. So let's consider this first term here. And let's expand it, expand out the SC2 indices. So what happens when the Higgs mechanism kicks in is that the vacuum expectation value of the neutral components of the Higgs fields get non-zero. So these two things are measured in GeV. So their mass dimension is 1. And actually, if you work out the two Higgs doublet model, what happens is that the Z mass is proportional to them in this way. So G1 and G2 are the U1 and SU2 left gauge couplings, respectively. So what happens for the neutral components, actually, is that so what we do is we now re-expand the quantum field theory and the oscillators of the zero charge component of the Higgs fields around this non-zero value. So we have this thing, which is just a number with some mass dimension. And then all the creation and annihilation operators now go into this new dynamical field, H2. And this thing is the Higgs boson that they'll be measuring, hopefully, in the LHC. Okay, so we have a constraint. We know what MZ is. We know what the gauge couplings are. So we know what the sum of the squares of these two vacuum expectation values is. So that means that V1 and V2, we can think of them in Pythagorean triangle and this angle here is called beta, and so there's an important parameter in the MSSM which is called tan beta, which is just the ratio of the two Higgs expectation values. So after the Higgs mechanism, we just replace our this H2 zero into our term here. And what we see is some term yu ij ul ix times v2 u right jx plus u l I x h2 0 u right bar jx plus some other terms. Yes.
I have two questions. Yes. The first one is, we've written in the top line, you have H20 and H2 plus, and now you're going to H20 and H10.
Okay. So, well, I'm just forgetting this term.
Okay.
And this is only there because we're going to have the same thing's going to happen in these terms with H1. That's all.
And then the second question is, if the little h20 is the Higgs boson, what's the little h10?
It's another Higgs boson in this two Higgs doublet model. So you get more than one Higgs, physical Higgs here. Yeah. In the standard model, we'd only have this one. So there's just one Higgs boson in the standard model. In fact, yeah. That's a good question. So how many Higgs boson degrees of freedom do we have? Well, we start off with two complex doublets. Okay, so that's got 8 real degrees of freedom. We know that 3 of these are going to get eaten. Okay, 2 of them, well, 1 of them gets eaten to form the longitudinal mode of the W plus. One for the longitudinal mode of the W minus, one by the Z. And so we end up with 5 physical Higgses. So they're written, okay, I mean, they're actually linear combinations of these basic fields that we've written before, electroweak symmetry breaking. But they're written like this. So three charged, neutral ones and 2 charged ones. You can work out the CP eigenstates of these. And these two have positive charge times parity. This one has negative charge times parity. The lightest guy, by convention, is called little h. Okay, so you'll see that written down. But the point I was getting at here, well, there are several points, actually. One thing to notice is this first term is a mass term, right? Because now we do, this is just a massive parameter, and now we do have the product of 2 chiral superfields. So when we take, remember the mass of the fermions, looks like d2w by d phi I d phi j. And so we're going to wind up with a non-zero value for the mass here for the up quarks in this case. And in fact, at the end of the day, it's going to look like a Dirac mass for the up quarks. And the mass matrix will be just the product of the vacuum expectation value of V2 times the dimensionless U Kawa couplings. Like that. And the other thing we notice is that H2 couples to the quarks. So this coupling, U Kawa coupling, is actually looks like U left, U right, H2 So this couples, so if I put family indices here, this coupling is actually proportional to the mass matrix. And that mechanism works, right? Because it's just, the coupling is YU, IJ, and the mass matrix divided by V2 is that number. And so this Higgs boson is coupling proportional to the mass of the thing it's coupling to. And that's true in the standard model as well. So this is why the Higgs boson couples proportional to mass. That has various consequences. It's even true for its couplings to gauge bosons like the W and the Z at tree level. Couplings proportional to the mass. Right, so in the standard model, we'd add a Lagrangian term. So we only have one Higgs doublet, the H2, the equivalent of the H2, and so for the down quarks, for instance, we can add so I'm forgetting the gauge indices, and there's some Yukawa coupling, plus the emission conjugate, right? So, the thing is that all of the quarks and the leptons are going to need these Yukawa couplings, because that's where they're going to get their masses from. We know they've got mass. And so in the standard model with one Higgs doublet, it's fine, because we can just add the dagger of H2. The dagger of H2 has the right hypercharge assignment, because it's got negative hypercharge assignment. But remember, now we're in SUSY. But in SUSY, the superpotential is holomorphic. So writing H2 dagger D right bar. BYD breaks. Would break SUSY in a hard way. So we're not allowed to write it. So this is another reason why we must add an additional Higgs boson with opposite hypercharge. So now I just, everything happens like it does here with the other terms in the superpotential, and we get some H1s and V1s. And if I do that expansion, we get a mass matrix for the charged leptons, which is V1 YE IJ over root 2, and we get a down quark mass matrix. I didn't write it with the root 2. YD IJ. Like that, and you get couplings of the H1 proportional to V1s and the Yukawa matrices as well. So this, Okay. Any questions on that? This mu term, as it's called, as I said before, it gives the mass to the Higgs bosons and to the Higgsinos. So another thing to notice is that all of the terms in WMSSM, which I wrote as RP, conserve baryon number and lepton number. Are you familiar with those? A bit. So quarks have baryon number is a third, and leptons have lepton number equals 1. That's all you need to know. Everything else is 0. And so, and of course, the anti-quarks have baryon have opposite or negative quantum numbers. So we always have like a quark times an anti-quark, so the total baryon number is 0. But actually, we haven't imposed those as symmetries yet. And in fact, they're violated non-perturbatively in the standard model. Perturbatively, they're kind of an accidental symmetry in the standard model. There are no interactions which are consistent with the standard model gauge symmetry at the perturbative level which violate those symmetries. But in the MSSM, there are. And if we really wrote down all interactions that were just invariant under SUSY and the standard model gauge group, we'd have to write a bunch more down. And I'm going to write them now. So normally people don't do this, and I'll explain why not. So I'm going to write it like this for reasons that will become clear. Oh, so these, oh yeah, sorry, these have colour, right? So, x, x, y, z, epsilon, x, y, z. H2. So these three, if you calculate it, these break lepton number, violate, lepton number, and this one violates baryon number. So these are terms you can't write down in the standard model, only in the SUSY counterpart. So these lead to dangerous interactions. If you've got all of them, you tend to get proton decay, or predict, you tend to predict proton decay. As far as is known, protons are stable. The experimental lifetime constraint on the lifetime is bigger than 10 to the 35 years from experiments at supercamiocandae. Grand unified theories actually predict proton decay at some rate comparable to this. So, in fact, that's initially what these experiments were looking for. They were looking for signal of protons decaying because it would be signal of interactions beyond the standard model. Yeah.
So, the accidental symmetry of ENL in the standard model, is that a kind of one rule?
Well, only perturbatively. I mean, non-perturbatively, you get instanton interactions which break them. So. I mean, yeah. Yeah, it would be like, it's like an, if on the perturbative level, it's like an accidental global U1. And in fact, it's not clear, actually, to be honest, whether lepton number is a perturbative symmetry at all. Because it depends how neutrinos get their mass. May well be that neutrinos have Majorana mass, and that breaks L anyway. Okay. All right, so we have this huge bound on the proton decay lifetime, and these interactions can give you proton decay. So it's actually going to be a tutorial, I think, is to roughly estimate from these interactions what you would expect for the proton decay lifetime without putting in all the factors, just get a very rough order of magnitude guess. But the process, or a process you could imagine happening, would be like this. So a proton contains UUD, as you know. So this coupling here is lambda primed 1 1 j. This coupling is lambda double primes 1 1 j. That's the baryon number. So this one breaks baryon number. Number is part of this, and this one breaks lepton number. So here on the left we have UUD, that's proton, sitting around in our supercamiocandae detector, and this on the right hand side will give you a pion and a positron. So this predicts proton going to pion and positron. And you know, depending on these couplings, which you're going to work out the dependence, the decay rate is typically seconds. Decay rate predicted is of order 1 second. So it's like a completely ruled out, right? So you'd have to put in like ridiculously small couplings, and you can work out how small they'd have to be in order to satisfy this bound. And so that looks very unnatural. And so what people prefer to do is put in a symmetry that gets rid of these terms, right? And there are actually quite a lot of different symmetries that you can use. But the one everyone uses, well, no, that's not quite true, but the one that the vast majority of people just assume, and when they say MSSM they mean including the symmetry, is a symmetry called R parity. So this thing, it's a discrete remnant of the continuous R symmetries that we talked about before. It's actually, it just takes either one of two values, either plus or minus one, and it's multiplicative symmetry. So it's a Z2 multiplicative. And R parity is defined to be minus 1 to the 3b minus l plus twice the spin. That's the spin of the particle. So it interacts with the spin. That's why it's a, you know, it's kind of an R symmetry type thing. All right. And what we're going to do next time. This has a lot of consequences phenomenologically and even cosmologically if you fix it like this. We're going to look next time and sketch out what the most important consequences of this adding this symmetry would be. But it sets all of these terms to zero. Now, that may well be overkill, because all the dangerous interactions are when you have both lepton number violation and baryon number violation. So all you have to do is either, you could just ban this one set of terms, and then you'd be fine with proton decay. Or you could, instead, you could ban all of the lepton number violating terms. So there are other possibilities. There are, however, quite strong, well, nowhere near as strong, but all of these couplings now are starting to get quite constrained. So it may well be that either that supersymmetry is completely wrong, or it's not true at low energies in nature, or that R parity is a good symmetry somehow. Okay, any questions on that? Okay, that's it for today. So next time we'll do some phenomenology. We'll talk about it.